side two of the tape with Stuart Brandenburg. Yeah, go ahead with what you were saying about Sig Olson on the other half of the tape.
My feeling about Sig was that when he was in the wilderness took over. And I think that was that influence characterized Howard Zonizer and Harvey Broom. Harvey Broom is an unsung hero of the Wilderness Society, one of the founders with Bob Marshall. I think it was an enveloping experience where the individual sensed certain influences on his or her mind when in a situation where the wilderness was the only prevailing influence. And I do think it was a spiritual thing. I think it went to the heart and the soul of these people, as it does me. I think in terms of some of the mysticism that we see with Native peoples who can get to other planes of human experience in a given setting within certain influences, I think when Sig was in the wilderness, the wilderness was the permeating, dominant influence on everything he did. And I think that's true with many of us. If we can be with good companions, but ourselves go out on the high ridge, or down in the spruce bottom, or out under the big cactus. I think that's where it reaches us. That's where it gets to us. As I look back, don't I regret not asking Sig, not asking Harvey, not asking Sonny? Why didn't we discuss this more? We said, we will save it. It's priceless. There's no human way of describing how much it means to us. But let's talk about what it does to us when we're out there in isolation. We didn't do it. I didn't do it enough to carry me to this day. But you provoke those thoughts. And I'm just as sure as I am sitting here with you, that if Zani was there, Sig was there, Ober, Harvey Broom were there, Ober, sir. They would say that, yes. The wilderness its consuming influence, it's what gives me spirit when I'm there.
Well, guys, this one thing that interests me, you represented back in the 50s, and at your testimony on the refuge, you represented the National Wildlife Federation, which was largely hunters and hunting interests, and yet apparently what you're saying connected with them, because I read your testimony and that apparently was approved by that organization. And even though this would not never be a major hunting ground, people allowed you to work on this and promote these values.
I think that was because of the breadth and depth of Charles Callison, the conservation director. That statement was never taken through an executive committee or a board. The organization, probably through resolution, said in so many words, we will support the establishment of the Arctic Range, there was not much direction except Callison saying, work on this. As Callison said, you will be given freedom to support Zionizer in your years here, 56 to 60, mm-hmm. after introduction of the bill. You will be concentrating mm-hmm. on the wilderness bill.
Mm-hmm.
I had to prepare in the last 2 years the weekly legislative report,
mm-hmm.
Report on the bills and action on the bills, clean air, clean water, the whole mm-hmm. spectrum of environmental issues. But he gave carte blanche support to Zionizer, and that meant that I traveled with Zionizer mm-hmm. even in the Echo Park controversy that preceded the introduction of the wilderness bill mm-hmm. before 56.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very, as you know, a very decisive victory for environmentalism, keeping the dams out of Dinosaur National Monument.
Right.
Well, there was nobody with Zionizer in the Senate chamber when John Kennedy stood on a crutch and made our appeal to protect the national park system from the intrusions of the Bureau of Reclamation, the dam
mm-hmm.
builders.
Mm-hmm.
That was when I became intimately acquainted with Callison and recognized how broad and deep he was. And that was when I grew very close, intimately connected with Howard Zionizer. And Howard Zionizer, if you were his friend, you became an intimate friend.
Mm-hmm.
He put his arms around you, tapped into your thinking, knew mm-hmm. what you were worried about, knew what your aspirations were. But gently, as a father, as my father, would say, you don't want to do that. Think about that.
Uh-huh.
And I was raised in that kind of a culture in my family
mm-hmm.
where when I wanted to be a smoke jumper, my dad said, no, you don't want to do that. That's romantic and stuff. You better get experience on range survey. You need to know range.
Mm-hmm.
Or you better go into a timber survey.
Uh-huh.
So I was constantly, well, one of those younger people that was malleable.
Mm-hmm.
And Zionizer knew that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a master in the most wonderful constructive way of mm-hmm. manipulating the human spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And here was this this field biologist that had this great family background. And he just took me and guided me and suggested mm-hmm. and cajoled in a gentle way. And
mm-hmm.
I just loved him dearly.
Interesting. Well, Stuart, is it, I guess, correct to say then that your advocacy on behalf of the Wildlife Federation for the Arctic Range and your testimony that we read here is largely a function of Zionizer's philosophy then?
And Zionizer and Callison, my
mm-hmm.
boss.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I was under the influence of the wilderness guys. I was under the influence of my mother and father
mm-hmm.
that loved the wild. And nobody in the Federation gave too much of a damn.
Mm-hmm.
And so Zionizer was working on me. Callison was working on me.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I was 35 years old when I gave this testimony.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I had this wonderful woman, Anna V., bringing out these great kids. And
mm-hmm.
But, you know, you remember when you were that age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You were feeling your way.
Uh-huh.
And so... I was increasingly appreciative of my field experience.
Mm-hmm.
I was damn proud of those 7 years, you know, not steady, but on the mountain goat.
Mm-hmm.
And then I hooked on to Olus.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going to the hearing with Olus on the dams on the Clearwater River, Bruce's Eddy and Penny Cliffs.
Mm-hmm.
And we were the only two conservationists in this big hearing room in the Department of Commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And Ola said to me, now, Stuart, we got to be careful that we don't get sucked into a discussion of where we want the dam, as mm-hmm. opposed to we don't want no dams, no how.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, here going with Ola's is my sidekick to testify, or mm-hmm. my being his sidekick.
Mm-hmm.
Those people really put the Indian sign in the most wonderful sense on me
mm-hmm.
and influenced me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was right. Mm-hmm. I mean, background, love of the wild country, and it was a transcending influence, and but culminating in Sennheiser's richness. And I think this is something I wanted to talk to you about. The gentle spirit of these people in dealing with people. They took care of you. And they would meet Roger Kay, and they would say, my God, what a man. Here within the bureaucracy and all the experiences that he had to put up with, buffeting and harsh as they are, here is this great guy, and how can we link with him, and how can we give him support and encouragement? There was this loving, caring for people, and it takes us back to where we started before we went on the date, how we need to indoctrinate our people who are wilderness advocates in reaching out for and nurturing other people. Mm-hmm. Nurturing, I think, is the key word. They looked at the individual who cared about a wilderness, but just a good person, how they could bring the best out of that person. And above all, that epitomized that crew. They were sensitive to people. When they saw people doing great things, they rejoiced in their accomplishments. When they saw people coming together to save the wilderness, it brought exhilaration to them. And this was a joyousness that just encompassed new friends. And those things, those capabilities, were what I tried to capture in the program that we took to the field, where, as I said, we didn't work always on the issues. Many times we came to give 3 days of strategy on saving the wilderness or protecting the river. We went from that to sessions where the Friday through Sunday meetings were devoted to what's it take to keep your spirit up? What is there in the wilderness that inspires you? How do we form circles of people in Alaska to keep our fires burning brightly, to take the defeats, the rebuffs, but to keep ourselves together and give ourselves strength and rejuvenation and this resilience to come through? And then, most importantly, how do we identify these people in our communities who care so deeply about the loss of these values and this wild country and the beauty of this land and the things that are being sacrificed through development? How do we reach to them and draw them in? And then once we have them in, what do we do to find a place for them to fit in to this movement? Everybody brings special knowledge, special background, special feelings. How do we get them beyond the despair that afflicts so many people? They care. They would give their all if we showed them how. And that is our role, to identify them, to bring them in, to find a role for them, to see them accomplish the things that are within their realm of capabilities and interests, and the joy that springs out of that, the exhilaration that comes out of that, as they become inspired with this great conviction that because they're here, this world is a better place. Because we're here, and because I was here, this wilderness is where it is. Because Roger Kay is here, he was doing this beautiful job, this thing is going to be saved in perpetuity. Without Roger, we couldn't have done it, but he did it. So there we go.
Well, Stuart, another thing I wanted to ask you, and this relates directly to your testimony in 59 to that Senate committee. You talk, you're talking in terms of the Wildlife Federation, and you mentioned that many people will never get to this Arctic refuge that was proposed at the time. And then you make this statement, and I'll quote you here in your testimony. You say, I quote, I have seen growing awareness of wilderness values on part of the members of our federation, unquote. Could you explain that a little bit? What value did you see for your members that would never go there?
In many ways, in this period, the conservation environmental movement was coming into its age. Mm-hmm. This was the emergence of conservation as a force in our society. And within the state organizations that made up the National Wildlife Federation, there was a sharp growth in the breadth and understanding of these individual men and women who led their state wildlife organizations. And their interests were dimensional in terms of clean air, clean water.
Oh, really?
Way beyond what their enjoyment of wildlife was.
Mm-hmm.
Hunting, fishing, good habitat. They had that, mm-hmm. but they responded to the leadership of the Federation in fighting for clean air, clean water. Then you remember in 56, we had made these massive mailings with the Federation's lists to these people saying, here is the wilderness bill,
mm-hmm.
here is the wilderness resource within these federal jurisdictions.
Mm-hmm.
This wilderness will not be preserved unless we set up a national policy and a system mm-hmm. For bringing these areas into the wilderness system.
Mm-hmm.
The individuals were in a period of the grassroots leaders, the state leaders, were in a period of tremendous growth. They were aware that the lands that they valued, the public lands, the wild country, the habitat, was imperiled. So it was really very easy for us to reach them in communication, in mailing alerts. Mm-hmm. Your congressman is on this committee. Would you please let him know mm-hmm. that you stood firmly for this legislation?
Mm-hmm.
So there was that ownership. And in the next few years, you recall that all of the major legislation fell in place. Mm-hmm. Wild and scenic rivers, endangered species,
mm-hmm.
The public land laws. And in the same period, there were raids against the national forest.
Mm-hmm.
The Timber Supply Act, the so-called Dewart Bill of the 40s, to take large parts of the national forest estate, transfer them to state ownership for distribution
mm-hmm.
and sale. Those battles, as with Echo Park Dam, a mm-hmm. precedent for invasion of the national park system by mm-hmm. the dam builders, these had sharpened people, and they savored the success of those battles carried on in Congress.
Mm.
Echo Park was a decisive defeat for the Bureau of Reclamation,
mm-hmm.
and those in the Colorado Basin, all those big, powerful states aligned to put those dams in the unit of the national park system.
Mm-hmm.
It was a massive effort, a media effort, a fundraising effort to wage that battle in Congress and to prevail.
Mm-hmm.
And that set the base for the wilderness bill. So mm-hmm. people were ready when here came these mailings, and all of a sudden everybody knew about the wilderness bill, and it was on the top of the priority list.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one group of people I was speaking for. But I also valued the mountain folks I had known.
The who?
The mountain folks. The mountain men.
Oh, really?
And the people who lived in the foothills, who had a feeling for the wild setting.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew from my experience that Frank Lance on the Salmon River had never really used the word wilderness much.
Mm-hmm.
But he savored the spiritual values that made him spend his life on mm-hmm. Lance Bar
mm-hmm.
in the midst of the wilderness year-round.
Mm-hmm.
and that made him the stalwart defender of the bighorn when the Salmon River Canyon was invaded by the prospectors, mm-hmm. and they began to take the sheep because of the savory meat.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank Land said, first you're going to contend with me if you take any of these bighorns. If there's anything left over, I'll take you into the law.
Mm-hmm.
Those people and some of the mountain men that worked for the Forest Service, mm-hmm. they were masters at getting through the woods, the double-bedded axe. They could handle a string of mules, the crosscut saw.
Mm-hmm.
They could climb a tree to hang a telephone wire. Those people had a feeling for that value.
Mm-hmm.
It hadn't been articulated. It hadn't been specified. They hadn't been reached by a Bob Marshall or a guy in Brandborg.
Mm-hmm.
But they had it, and it was there.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings me to the point of the cultural values that you allude to.
Mm-hmm.
It's my conviction that, as you know, our people grew up with wilderness,
mm-hmm.
as they came across this continent,
mm-hmm.
the pioneers. And I think people living on the homestead must have had that spiritual feeling that some of the artists capture,
mm-hmm.
when they show the housewife out in the field and meadows,
mm-hmm.
you know, some of that great artwork,
mm-hmm.
In the prairie setting or in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
I think that wilderness invaded the human spirit and made the presence of those animals and plants, mm-hmm. a part of what people miss so now much now when 90% of us confined to the urban setting.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we go? We go to the beach, the mountains, the prairie, the desert, mm-hmm. the river, the lake. We go out,
mm-hmm.
and that's it. And as if we get people to say, well, what is it you're after?
Mm-hmm.
The ultimate is wildness. And where mm-hmm. do you find that but the wilderness?
Mm-hmm.
And that this is in our culture. This is deep in us because we got to have the outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
And we may tear it up with ski resorts and development just because of nobody ever saying, well, what is it you're really after?
Mm-hmm.
And we may say, oh, the big bull, the big ram,
mm-hmm.
and get that in there. Well, for some people, that may be part of the wilderness. But for most people today, what is it, 70%, 80%? For for those people, the sight of the living creature in a natural setting,
mm-hmm.
is the ultimate,
mm-hmm.
the human experience.
Yeah, one last thing, Stuart. I noticed in your living room here, you've got a number of books by Seton in a prominent place here. They're children's books. Why are they here?
Well, I think because...
Oh, wait.
With the feeling and the encompassing of what's there,
mm-hmm.
People will say, of course,
mm-hmm.
we've got to have an Arctic range and all of the rest of the wilderness system.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to go for 250 million acres,
mm-hmm.
which should be our ultimate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because in your testimony here on the Arctic range in 59, you talk, and I'll quote you, about the experiences and conditions that have contributed so much to our inner strength of our people and the nation. So this is our cultural heritage, you're saying.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's beautiful. Obviously, must have been effective, like you say, because you referred to it so strongly here in your testimony, and it must have resonated with hunters who maybe discovered that, yeah, that's why I really hunt. That.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that the good sportsman that cares about those animals, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what the circumstances were that day or in the days before when I wrote that testimony.
Mm-hmm.
I can't recapture that. My mind is like a sieve on many of those important details.
But it's very much in line with your testimony is just following what you tell me here today.
Well, I hope it is.
It is. And some of the other documents, actually, that I found in the archives, some of your correspondence. Well, Stuart, that's all the questions I have. I want to thank you for that and ask if there's anything else you'd like to say or add about wilderness, the Arctic Refuge, or your hope for the future.
Well, I want to thank you for the privilege of participating in this vital work group. Commendation. One thing stands out in my experience. Today, in working to protect the beauty of the Bitterroot Valley, but most notably from the years, 32 years in Washington, D.C., we will succeed in direct proportion to our ability to use the gentle, persuasive approaches that we find in Sennheiser and Bolus to bring the best out of people. The American people basically care about their land and about each other. Most have receded in frustration from active involvement in the social and political issues of our day. They've given up. I think within the wilderness movement, we have to reach out, let them see the glory of the Arctic Range and the Selway Bitterroot and the Pelican Islands and Okefenokee. But once they say, yes, this is worthwhile, this is worth committing my time and energies in life to showing them how they can be participants, nurturing them, finding a niche for them. And we can do that by taking the very skills that we find epitomized in these individuals, going out to the working circles of dedicated men and women, and talking about and developing the systems which are old and tried and true for showing people what they can do as they realize their own power in influencing the course of the empire. And, of course, this great fulfillment that comes to individuals as they approach, as they proceed to bring change for the better, so that they can look back on a lifetime and say, because I was here, the world's a better place. And the joy and fulfillment that comes out of that, and showing that people how to work and relate closely together, and to be each other's best friends and trust each other, and hammer out the differences that inevitably occur between us as you and I work together, or as any team works together, but to rejuvenate and re-inspire and develop the resilience to take the inevitable rebuffs and setbacks, but to build that into us through a planned, intentional system of indoctrinating people in the great art of using democracy for all that it can deliver to us. We've got it. We know how great our people are. We know how great some of our wilderness and other leaders are. We need to show those leadership circles how to share and bring other people into the circle of activism that will save the wilderness and bring it to us in perpetuity.
Well, thank you. Well, as this is Roger Kay again, and as Stuart and I were just concluding here, his wife, Anna V. Brandberg, came up and said, well, there's some things you should know about Sig Olson and Olas and Sennheiser. So please go ahead and add to it.
I would say that Zani was somebody you just immediately loved.
Uh-huh.
He That's good.
Mm-hmm.
He was a fine person. He just felt good in his presence.
Hmm.
And you didn't have to know him real well to love him. But we knew him well. I knew him well.
Mm-hmm.
I knew his family.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a quality about him that you couldn't help but just love. And the same is true of Sig. Sig was...
This is Sig Olson.
Sig Olson.
Mm-hmm.
Sig, was just a lovely person that you just immediately loved also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I can't give any big examples other than just being with him. You were glad to be there and glad mm-hmm. to have him with you.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wonderful. He knew his wife, and she was a beautiful person, too. But then Horace was a little different sort of person, in that he was like, sitting with him was like sitting next to Christ.
Mm.
He had a spiritual quality about him that was different than most people.
Mm.
And he would sit and look at things and talk about things. And he just felt that this was a real fine spirit than just a man.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Okay. Go ahead.
Stuart Brandborg, adding to Annavie's comment, because she captures something that is so real in my experience. Sig had a great, loving, generous quality in reaching out to you and reaching out to the stranger. And that was shared by Zani, who just in his soft and gentle way became part of you in any discussion. He would do the same with the lovely people that waited on us at the Cosmos Club, or that we stood on a street corner with, waiting for a light to change. This projection of real awareness of the individual, and where are you today? And here's what I've been doing today. That was very much a part of these people. The same was true with Harvey Broome. An innate sweetness, a generosity, a caring that just radiated out of these individuals, and that would make a friend out of most anybody you encountered. But the aura of Olus in his humble, sweet way, addressing a group of 200 and being totally Olus, no paper to read, no outline of points he should cover, getting up with complete informality and saying, this is what I feel in the wilderness, and this is what I feel from the energy of the people in this group. And the one word we haven't mentioned today is energy. But there's a real conviction that if you're in the wilderness setting, you draw great energy from all of those things that are a part of that wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
Olus, in his simplicity and his humility and his soft-spoken, informal voice just brought you right to him, and you thought, well, here is a great spirit, a great human being that epitomizes so much that is fine and worthy in our world.
Hmm. Right.